genuinely powerful in future. We talk blithely of disruption in business, when revenue streams built over decades can be grabbed by startups over a matter of months, if not weeks. But few seem to have grasped that this extends to power structures too. The far-reaching impacts of this power shift can be compared with the wide-ranging and often breathtakingly fast impact of the internet on many traditional businesses. The retail sector is an obvious example. Even the most traditional heritage retailers are forced to address the vast challenge of online shopping opportunities. A few firms have been the disruptors, others have embraced the change, a third group is plodding along, trying to catch up with shifts that have already happened. In the UK, a number of long-established high street brands have gone into receivership. Others struggle to redefine their business. A walk down any British high street, now usually a string of coffee shops, restaurants, hairdressers, nail bars and dentists, alongside a few specialist stores, shows how dramatically our shopping habits have changed even over the past few years. In 2006, 9 retailers dominated the US market. Amazon accounted for just 4% of the group's total market value. By 2016, Amazon was 55% of the total. With over 750 million mobile users, more than 4 times all of its competitors combined, it has, in the words of John Kurtzier, one retail, reinventing how we buy and receive products. Amazon achieved this amazing feat by creating a personal, yet automated, connection with their customers, tracking their history and searches to understand their needs, and delivering great service. For retailers and so many other sectors now, a digital strategy is not peripheral to the main event. It is the main event. The irony is that to formulate and continuously evolve the right digital strategy, businesses need the right human minds, and that means the right combination of minds. It's not a question of digital or human, but digital plus human. Companies therefore need to take the optimization of their talent seriously. The impact of getting it right or wrong may not be immediate, but any company that drags its feet in developing its collective human intelligence will be less likely to succeed than smarter competitors and increasingly disconnected from its customers. Astute companies are already working hard to develop the right ecosystems where their diverse talent helps create an intelligent working environment and strong customer engagement. Out of this arise exciting opportunities for equality, but we could too easily squander them by failing to see that today's destabilizing changes offer the moment for a leap forward in the quest for gender and other equalities. A continuation of the past would not have got us to where we want to be, even if, superficially, it might seem more benign. Whether you agree with Brexit and Trump is not the point. These votes show that there's an urgent desire for new ways of thinking and new leadership. Even if you detest the outcomes, instead of wringing your hands, which I'm pretty sure will not influence what happens next, let's take advantage of that desire for change. My experience in helping to solve a much narrower problem, the underrepresentation of women on UK corporate boards, showed me, just as the chance to be Newton's CEO had done, how dislocations can create rare moments of opportunity to seize. To capitalise on this moment today, women need to tap into their own feminine brand of power. It works. I was definitely on the outside of the real power base when it came to making changes in the boardroom, but was able to become effective by being empathetic and constructive in my approach. I reached out rather than fought. Girl power, if you like, but not as we may have thought of it before. This is not about adopting the trappings of male power, but about redefining power, changing rather than mimicking the power structures that we have been largely excluded from in the past. This is our moment to show the strength of feminine power. Chapter 3. The 30% Club, the strength of feminine power. When you start to develop your powers of empathy and imagination, the whole world opens up to you. Susan Sarandon. Having been appointed in rather unorthodox and dramatic fashion to be Newton's chief executive, I focused on delivering the results that were proof I was up to the job. Achieving strong results, both investment and financial performance, requires the right team. And with Newton's motto that no one has a monopoly on great ideas, my colleagues and I made a deliberate effort to develop diversity of thought and perspective. Just as on a football pitch, the best investment teams are not necessarily groups of the most highly qualified individuals. The interaction between team members plays a vital role. In common with the rest of the fund management industry, although Newton had a strong meritocracy, there were relatively few senior women. I wanted to do something to specifically address this. Young women, both at Newton and in other firms, were often approaching me to ask my advice, usually about combining career and family life, and I was happy to talk one-to-one. It seemed an obvious next step to try to help on a bigger scale. With the encouragement of my Boston-based boss, Ron O'Hanley, I launched a women's initiative for our parent company's European businesses in 2005. This initiative, like most other companies' gender diversity efforts at the time, centered on networking events, often a talk from a high-profile woman. The feedback was always how inspiring, but in fact, no one seemed inspired to actually do anything differently. Over the next few years, we saw little change in the representation of women at senior levels, and no real evidence that this was likely to change any time soon. Discouraged, I was about to give up when I was invited to give one of those talks myself at Goldman Sachs as part of their 2009 Diversity Week. Afterwards, Goldman hosted a discussion for 15 men and women from different organizations, and everyone shared what they were doing to encourage their female talent. As I listened, I discovered that I was far from alone. Everyone was struggling, no matter how hard and how long they had been trying. So much effort, yet so little to show for it. It seemed pretty clear that we must all be doing something wrong. One of the attendees was Baroness Mary Gowdy, a Labour peer. We agreed that we wanted to do something to break the deadlock. The approach needed a complete rethink. Of course, it's usually much easier to identify a problem than to come up with a solution. There was no reason to believe that the objective of having many more women in senior roles was simply unobtainable. There were plenty of ambitious women, plenty of companies keen to see them progress. As I searched for a way forward, I read widely about whether any companies had managed to achieve better progress. I also researched organizational behavior more generally and the theories about differences in the ways men and women typically work. The more I thought about it, the more obvious it seemed that most of us were rushing to try to motivate underrepresented talent without really understanding what was on these employees' minds or how our efforts would fit in with the rest of their experiences at work. I came across a number of interesting practical ideas. One was an effort by Deutsche Telekom to ensure that there were at least 30% women at all levels of seniority. I liked that specific numeric target and realized that most of us were making a mistake in not setting clear goals. We needed to measure our progress or lack of it and have a way of tracking women's advancement just like our other business objectives. The literature I was reading on group behavior suggested that 30% was a point at which critical mass was reached. And that resonated with me personally. As I thought about my own experiences, being the only woman in the room made me feel self-conscious, and I chose my interventions carefully on those occasions. If there were several items on the agenda where I might have a different opinion from the rest of the group, I would speak up about just one or two. If there were 3 women out of 10 people, I was just another person in the room, and felt confident to speak freely. The way in which Deutsche Telekom was promoting its ambition was also appealing. Taking on more women in management positions is not about the enforcement of misconstrued egalitarianism, said the company's then chief executive, René Obermann. Having a greater number of women at the top will quite simply enable us to operate better. Not only was the statement striking and deliberately distancing the move from political correctness and towards the business case, but it was all the more impactful coming from a man. I realized that women talking to women about women's issues was never going to get us very far. We can encourage each other and feel less alone, but we are likely to need those in leadership positions, mostly men, to help us actually succeed, to open those doors that may be half closed. This is nothing to be embarrassed about. Men on the way up in their careers have long had champions or sponsors in more senior positions who act as a sounding board, give them a reference, or even line them up for the next role. But it still wasn't obvious how to pull these thoughts into an action plan, so Mary and I invited almost all the senior businesswomen we knew to a lunch to solicit their input. Over 40 came along. I stood up and suggested that we needed a new approach if we were to break the deadlock and see more women fulfil their potential in our businesses. Some of those present made it clear afterwards that they did not want to be part of a specific women's initiative, expressing concerns about how that would be perceived by their male peers. Later, I'm happy to say, and particularly after men had joined the campaign, a number of those women became generous supporters. Others were sceptical about the idea that we might ever be able to find a better way forward after so many years of disappointing progress. All they could see ahead was an extrapolation of the past. But a new opportunity was arising just as we were having these discussions. We needed a vision, not a spreadsheet. The giant, cataclysmic dislocation of the global financial crisis had thrown up a new possibility for us to explore. As analysts, regulators, and policymakers pored over the wreckage of the financial collapse, it seemed obvious with hindsight that bank boards and management teams comprised almost entirely of conventional, middle-aged, affluent men were inherently flawed. The directors might be individually brilliant, but if they were cut from the same cloth, educated similarly, and moved in the same social circles, they were far more likely to back each other's opinions than to challenge them. Groupthink is far from a new concept. The term was devised in 1952 by American William White. He used it to refer to similar people not just agreeing with each other, but more perniciously believing that they are right and good as well, and so excluding dissenting voices. It's not an unusual phenomenon. Many catastrophes long before the 2008 financial crisis have been blamed at least in part on groupthink, including the January 1986 Space Shuttle Challenger disaster, when the shuttle broke up within 2 minutes of takeoff, killing the 7 crew members. The analysis of what went wrong showed how the inconvenient truth spoken by engineers concerned about the risks of launching in unusually cold conditions was disregarded by NASA managers in their go fever. A decade earlier, psychologist Irving Yanis had studied American foreign policy disasters and identified 8 symptoms of groupthink. The symptoms include the illusion of invulnerability, minds closed to warnings, the stereotyping of dissenters as stupid or biased, and pressure on group members to conform or be silent. Sadly, it seems hard to learn from our mistakes. The subject matter was different in the financial crisis, but the hallmarks of groupthink were present again. By early 2010, the realization was growing that the boardroom, described by former fund manager Lord Miners in 2008 as a retirement home for the great and the good, needed a big shake-up. The door was ajar for different types of people to become directors, and an obvious place to start was to address the scarcity of women on boards. In 2008, fewer than 12% of the directors at the UK's top 100 listed companies were women. Almost a quarter of those companies had all-male boards. Royal Bank of Scotland had just one female director out of 18 at the time of its ill-fated acquisition of ABN AMRO that precipitated the bank's downfall. Many of these board members had very similar backgrounds too. In fact, studying a picture of the 17 male directors at the time is like playing a game of spot the difference. It may be hard to believe, but the boards of the next 250 biggest UK-listed companies, the FTSE 250, were even more male-dominated. In 2008, less than half of FTSE 250 companies had any female directors at all, and the average representation was just 7%. Besides risking groupthink, 93% men is clearly not representative of society or almost any company's customer base. This was a big, emerging and brand new opportunity, so I persevered with the idea of doing something different, despite the lukewarm feedback. I arranged a smaller lunch for 14 women out of the group of 40 who had responded positively. We were meeting on a Monday. The Friday before, I suddenly felt anxious that we might have yet another inconclusive conversation. I emailed attendees suggesting the specific idea of the 30% Club. Over Monday's lunch, we agreed on the simple, narrow but ambitious goal to reach 30% women on UK company boards over the following 5 years through voluntary, business-led change. The members of the club needed to be the chairman of the boards, since these were their boards and they had the authority to change things. Of course, they were almost exclusively chairmen. At the time, just a single FTSE 100 company, Land Securities, had a female chair, Dame Alison Carnworth. Dame Alison has been a fantastic supporter of the 30% Club, but we needed more than one. So that very same afternoon, we tested out the 30% Club idea on two highly regarded and prominent FTSE 100 chairmen, Sir Roger Carr, then chairman of Centrica, and Sir Wynne Bischoff, then chairman of Lloyds Bank. Would they support a campaign led by chairmen aimed at reaching 30% women on boards? Both immediately said yes. In their own words, "When we have women on our boards, the dynamic is better, the decision-making is better, but there are too few of them." Sir Roger's and Sir Wynne's evangelism transformed the thinking around the issue. There were many dissenters and sceptics to start with, but the endorsement of these leading male captains of industry made others sit up and take note. Maybe, just maybe, the underrepresentation of women on boards was about more than just fairness. A new dynamic began to develop, encouraging more business leaders to join in. This different angle also proved newsworthy. When we launched later that year, with seven founding chairman supporters, the Financial Times ran both a cover story and a prominent interview featuring Sir Roger and Sir Wynne. The message was clear. The scarcity of women at the top was no longer a women's issue, but everyone's issue. Men and women were going to work together to resolve it. But evangelism does not necessarily lead to results. Another newspaper wrote at the time that the 30% Club had a worthy ambition, but was very vague about how it was going to achieve it. I soon realised that this vagueness was in fact an essential ingredient. Nothing had worked before, so we needed to draw up a new map to reach our destination. We were wholly open to fresh ideas. We listened and adapted quickly as we made progress or encountered setbacks. Most of the time it was like driving in fog. We could see the immediate few feet in front, but the rest of the route was unclear. As long as we kept progressing and learning from what was working and what wasn't, we could reach the goal. I became a great believer in pilots to test ideas quickly rather than endless theorising. After all, we knew we had to experiment to make progress. The approach the 30% Club took was to think big, start small, but start now. The fear of what might go wrong. In 2016, Harvard Business School professor Iris Bonnet, the author of the acclaimed book What Works? Gender Equality by Design, wrote a case study about the rapid rise in the number of women on UK boards, something that has so far eluded the United States. Iris invited me over to help teach the case study to the first group of students. I had never even been to a Harvard MBA class, let alone taught one, and it was a fascinating experience. Professor Bonnet split the 80 students into five groups, each role-playing one of the parties involved, the government, the cross-party task force established under Labour peer Lord Mervyn Davis, the 30% Club, the executive search community, and investors. The students' first task was to list the difficulties they saw ahead. I then explained what had actually happened, whether the anticipated problems arose, and how we overcame them. It was an intriguing exercise. The students came up with a cumulative total of no less than 53 potential problems. Many did arise, and I started my remarks by noting that it was lucky I had not heard them before we embarked on a campaign, as it would have seemed an impossible task. It is so easy to come up with reasons not to do something. There is always something that might go wrong. It is often very hard to envisage how to navigate through problems before they arise, but when we encounter them, I found, we can often cope and find a way through. It's very important not to panic at the lack of visibility or the unexpected twists and turns, but to see that as part of the journey. That holds true in our careers as well as our personal lives, and helps us achieve so much more than if we hesitate over each step for fear of not being able to see the next, or of how we will cope when we get there. As it turned out, despite the wobbles and setbacks, the 30% Club's timing caught the mood of the moment. The financial crisis created real appetite for change. Then, a few months after the 30% Club launch, Lord Davis concluded his cross-party public review into the scarcity of women on UK company boards. He made 10 recommendations. Like the 30% Club, he backed voluntary action rather than mandatory quotas. Lord Davis told me at the time that he had a number of reasons not to recommend legislation. One was that his daughter would never speak to him again. Another was that the 30% Club chairman supporters had promised that if given the chance, they would deliver progress through voluntary action. Over the next 5 years, the Davis Steering Committee and the 30% Club formed a powerful double act, combining supportive public policy with private sector action. By the time we reached our shared self-imposed deadline of end 2015, the results for the FTSE 100 fell between Lord Davis's 25% and our 30% goals. Over 26% of FTSE 100 board positions were held by women, and there were no longer any all-male FTSE 100 boards. The next biggest 250 companies had achieved even more progress from their weaker starting position, nearly 20% female directors and just 15 all-male boards. This wasn't an extrapolation of the past. It was a big leap forward. It was very exciting to see this jump in the numbers, but even more exciting to see a change in the thinking. The issue was now being seen through a different lens, and success led to more success, increasing the acceptability of what we were aiming for so that eventually it just became expected. In November 2011, I interviewed Sir Philip Hampton for the 30% Club website. At the time of our interview, he was chairman of the Royal Bank of Scotland, having taken that role after the bank had been bailed out. One of his immediate tasks was to appoint a new board. It is unusual for the chairman of a big company to have carte blanche, and Sir Philip talked me through his thought process. The previous 18-member board was far too big, as well as homogenous. Sir Philip set about creating a 12-member board with at least three women, some international experience relevant to RBS, and also, as he put it to me, a blend of experienced directors with fresher faces. He wanted diversity of character and background. 12 former CEOs would not make for a good boardroom dynamic. As we were talking, he said he wanted to tell me something that he thought I would find encouraging. Every year, a group of FTSE 100 chairmen gathered for lunch. They had met almost exactly a year before when the 30% Club had just formally launched. The conversation turned to the initiative, and there was a very brief discussion about whether this was something that should be supported. Sir Philip said that it was quickly closed down as not really for us. The same annual lunch had taken place just the week before Sir Philip and I were meeting. This time, the topic had been extensively discussed, and there was no question over whether to support the initiative. Instead, the chairmen were asking each other what they were doing to actually meet the target. What a difference a year can make. But it wasn't just the zeitgeist or the combination of voices that made an impact. The 30% Club's tactics were different from anything that had been tried before. In some respects, deliberately so, in others, more a stroke of luck. Through both the campaign's successes and failures, I learned a lot about how to effect change. I believe it's a replicable formula that can help us reach our bigger ambition of gender equality. There were 7 success factors. I've mentioned 5. Seizing the opportunity created by dislocation, focusing on the business aspects rather than merely the fairness issue, having a measurable goal with a deadline to create urgency, involving men with the ability to change things, and being open to new ideas. The 6th was something of a fake-it-till-we-make-it approach. The 30% Club took one step forward, but we would act as if we had taken 2. We talked up the progress. We celebrated good stories. We were confident. This did not always come easily. But I could see that people wanted to become part of a successful movement, and that there was a circularity to that success. The more progress we made, the more progress we were likely to continue making. The intriguing aspect was, the bolder I became in my requests, the more likely the response was to be yes. One particularly ambitious event was a Washington, D.C. breakfast, generously hosted by KPMG, and deliberately planned to coincide with the 2014 IMF conference. The U.S. chapter of the 30% Club had just been launched, and while Peter Grauer, the dedicated and energetic founding chairman supporter, would be on the West Coast at the time talking to Silicon Valley entrepreneurs about the campaign, we saw an opportunity to raise the 30% Club's global profile just before the IMF's official business got underway in DC. Mark Carney, governor of the Bank of England and father of 4 girls, would be attending the conference, so I asked Sir Roger, who was then serving as a non-executive director on the bank's court, this is a tight-knit community, if he could see whether the governor might be prepared to speak at our breakfast. The answer was encouraging, but not definite. The governor's office explained they could not mark up his diary, but said that Mr. Carney was minded to accept if he was free. This left me in something of a bind. I wanted to encourage global bank chiefs to come to the breakfast, but they were much more likely to do so if the governor was speaking. I spent a week of our family summer holiday handwriting notes, which kept flying into the hotel pool, to invite CEOs and policymakers to the event, indicating that we expected the governor to be our speaker. Meanwhile, I kept the governor's office up to date with a list of expected influential attendees, as that would surely increase the chances of his attendance. Brenda Snowden of ANZ Bank, who later took on the mantle of leading the 30% Club, worked tirelessly to round up those acceptances. Finally, it was confirmed that the governor would speak. Unlikely as it seems, this whole precarious plan, infused with a dose of bravado, paid off. The room was full of influential men and women, and the governor spoke openly and eloquently about the bank's 300-year tradition and the importance of diversity in creating a modern culture. The bank CEOs, seated at tables at the front, took turns with the microphone to contribute their own thoughts and ideas about how to accelerate progress around the globe. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. The 30% Club's final key success factor was taking a feminine approach to solving a business problem. The word feminine divides people. Some object to the very idea that there are characteristics more generally associated with girls and women. Of course, there can be as much or more difference between individuals of the same gender as between the genders. That is, in my view, perfectly compatible with using the words feminine or masculine to describe traits more commonly found in either girls or boys. It certainly doesn't mean that those words apply to every individual girl or boy. I've also encountered the anxiety that by using the term, we may perpetuate gender inequalities. In fact, I believe the opposite may be true. If we understand each other's average differences better, we can develop more gender-intelligent strategies to encourage both men and women to thrive, rather than try to force everyone into a system that tends to motivate one or the other. It's important to recognize that we can be equal but different if we're really going to achieve progress. It's a contentious topic, and we'll explore it more fully in the next chapter. For now, let's use feminine as perhaps imperfect shorthand for the approach that defined the 30% Club. We were not looking to assume the traits of the group that we were aiming to join, not trying to simply replace a few men with a few women who were just the same. The goal was and remains more diversity of thought, of approach, of behaviours. The 30% Club's approach therefore emphasised, not downplayed difference, and in particular the qualities associated with women and girls, empathy, social sensitivity, collaboration, and gentleness. Encouraging voluntary action rather than legislation or quotas to achieve our goal of more women on boards was the most obvious manifestation of this feminine approach. Forcing people to do something would have completely undermined what we were trying to do. Quotas are very much command and control, a confrontational rather than an empathetic approach. Few people seem to understand this, focusing on the speed of attaining results, not what those results really signified. The 30% Club's ambitious goal was that men and women would become unified in desiring boards with a better gender balance, and that this would help improve culture throughout their organisations, as well as increasing the numbers of women on boards. We wanted to ensure not only that the very best people serve on boards, but to open up the definition of best. So it did not mean just like the existing directors. Another symptom of our feminine approach was to be open source, to partner not only with the Davis Committee, but with many others who are already doing great work in this area. There was no sense of competition, helped by the fact that the 30% Club was not a diversity business, simply a group of business leaders focused on achieving results. Members of the steering committee included leaders of successful initiatives like the Professional Boards Forum, which introduces chairmen to women with the undiscovered potential to be non-executive directors. The forum stages events where candidates solve fictitious boardroom problems. Its success rate, attendees appointed to boards, is impressive, with 45 alumni appointed as non-executive directors to date. We had no desire to reinvent the wheel, but look to provide cohesion to fragmented efforts, as well as fill in any gaps. Through this joined-up approach, we created a ripple effect, gradually widening out our radius of influence. Importantly, that included the media, which got firmly and consistently behind the campaign, amplifying our voice. Heather McGregor, now Professor McGregor, Dean of Edinburgh Business School, then Mrs. Moneypenny, Financial Times columnist, and one of our brilliant 30% Club steering committee members, was instrumental in keeping the story on the front pages. Everyone involved was generous with their time and expertise. Numerous intensive research projects were conducted on a pro bono basis, as was the broader publicity campaign, masterminded by Gay Collins, another stalwart member of the steering committee. It was incredible, really, seeing how determination and dedication could achieve so much with no money changing hands. Without being especially conscious of it at the start, we were drawing towards us people with the ability and authority to change things, to the point where they believed in the desirability of the goal. If they came to think of it as their own idea, so much the better. I discovered a new power of persuasion in myself, intensified by strong allies. Sir Wim Bischoff spoke about my tactics on stage at a dinner some years later in New York. "Without us realizing what Helena was doing, she was getting us to do the work," he said with a broad smile. Several of the chairmen and I became good friends. It was fun making progress in such a positive, harmonious way. The chairman came up with many of the specific ideas. Sir Wynn made an impromptu announcement on stage at one 30% Club event that we would now set a 30% target for women in executive roles, and in front of the bemused audience asked me, as I sat in the front row, what timescale we should set for that. Sir Roger suggested that chairman deliberately instructed search firms to look beyond their comfort zones and specifically at least one level below their normal seniority levels for boardroom candidates. Robert Swannell, then chairman of Marks & Spencer, kept up the pressure by stating frequently that he would rather have joined a 50% club. I soon saw just how much more could be achieved once those on the inside campaigned for those on the outside to join them. I firmly believe that male champions of change are important if we are to see real progress. For a start, men saying they wanted more women to join them was so much more convincing than if I'd said we should have the same opportunity. Stated by a woman, the message can seem self-serving or become blurred with a fairness argument. Stated by a man, the business case is, for now, heard more clearly. The idea that men in positions of influence can be highly effective champions of gender equality is nothing new. In 1848, Frederick Douglass, a leader of the American anti-slavery movement, strongly defended Elizabeth Cady Stanton against criticism of her Declaration of Sentiments, a statement of women's rights modelled on the United States Declaration of Independence. In Britain, John Stuart Mill, the eminent economist, philosopher, and also then a Member of Parliament, presented a petition in 1866 to the House of Commons in favour of women's suffrage. The following year, he added an amendment to the 1867 Reform Act, which was aimed at giving many more working men the vote. Mill substituted the word person for man. His amendment was defeated by 194 votes to 73, but helped the suffrage movement to gain momentum, and Mill continued to advocate strongly for equal rights for women. He wasn't exactly typical, however. 50 years later, British suffragette Emmeline Pankhurst called on men to champion the cause of women's right to vote in her famous Freedom or Death speech, recounting, "One woman broke the windows of the guard club. Some of the guards came out and they said, 'Why did you break our windows? We have done nothing.' She said, 'It is because you have done nothing I have broken your windows.'" In 1926, Serbian-American inventor, engineer, and visionary Nikola Tesla gave an interview published under the title When Woman is Boss. Tesla foresaw the dramatic impacts of wireless technology alongside the acquisition of new fields of endeavor by women. He asserted, "It is not in the shallow physical imitation of men that women will assert first their equality and later their superiority, but in the awakening of the intellect of women." And critically, men can be the most powerful advocates not only for women's progression, but also for appropriate behaviours towards us. Ben Bailey Smith, better known by his stage name Doc Brown, is a leading and compelling advocate for men to be respectful to women. Speaking at a school in 2013, he pointed out to his male audience, "Men that are older than us have somehow created a world where we're supposed to believe that girls are somehow secondary to us." He added, "We have the power to change that. You have the power. I have spoken because now people listen to me." I met Ben when we were both being interviewed on Women's Hour, and he told me that when he started working to improve attitudes towards women, particularly amongst young black men, he experienced a backlash from some of his fans who challenged him, saying he wasn't cool. Ben has two daughters and a famous sister, the novelist Zadie Smith, and is convinced that weak men prey on the vulnerable, whereas strong men will use their power to improve things, including railing against the objectification of women. The history of feminism shows how the involvement of men has ebbed and flowed, varying from times when men, often just a few enlightened individuals, have proactively sought to help correct what they have recognized as a wrong, to episodes of sisters doing it for themselves. When I was a child, the second wave of feminism, the suffrage movement being denoted the first, although there were earlier advocates of women's rights, was in full swing, and the image portrayed by the media that feminists were anti-men and militant. A woman could be a feminist or feminine, but not both. The words actually spoken by women at the time suggest that this was not an accurate picture. On 22nd of March 1971, the date of my fifth birthday, in case you're wondering, I wasn't actually listening at the time, American academic and feminist activist Kate Millett was interviewed by Sue McGregor on BBC Radio 4. Millett suggested that men and children, as well as women, could live much freer lives without this oppressive patriarchal social system. The presenter summed up her ambition. "You're not out for an equal slice of the cake as it stands today. You're out to change the recipe." But there was little receptivity to this way of thinking in the 1970s, and the message became distorted. In the same interview, Millett suggested that many of the ideas of the feminist movement at the time were being misrepresented and portrayed as destructive because the establishment felt very threatened. She stressed that, contrary to reports, the movement was not out to demolish anything, but was looking to build new, additional lifestyle choices and for basic human rights to be bestowed on women. The goal was not that women take on the oppressive qualities of the very system they were trying to change. Specifically, she said, she hoped for less of the violence associated with masculinity. "This really is possible now. I see men everywhere, although admittedly not every man, looking to encourage women and girls, welcoming our progress rather than feeling threatened by it. They are conscious of the changes in our world, aware that the old system needs changing too, and are often extra motivated by talented daughters." When the 2015 Oxford and Cambridge Women's Boat Race finally, after 186 years, took place on the same day over the same course as a men's race, helped by Newton's sponsorship, I was a little unsure how it would be received, given the iconic status of the men's boat race. As Newton's then CEO, it was wonderful to be greeted warmly by many, including men, as I walked with my husband along the pathway by the Thames, and as my whole family watched at the finish line. The overwhelming feedback was that the women's presence modernised the boat race and that it was about time too. That reaction revealed just how far we have already come. It is a sign of confidence and strength now for men to support gender equality. We should extend our hand to them, to work with the men in power today to create a world where that power is shared. We should use our feminine qualities to work collaboratively and to achieve far greater progress together, as the 30% Club did on a small but symbolic scale to create change in the very traditional British boardroom. To become equal, but to stay different. Chapter 4. Men, women, equal, different. I think the fallacy is to think that women's liberation meant that men and women would become interchangeable. That has not happened, and most men and women would not want it to happen. Christina Hoff Summers. As the mother of nine, six girls and three boys, I sometimes say, only half-jokingly, that the Morrissey family offers a big enough sample size for me to be quite confident that there are clear behavioural differences between the sexes. There is, of course, no linkage between my children's gender and their intelligence, and the nine span a wide spectrum of academic abilities, personalities, creativity, and very many other characteristics. But when it comes to emotions and relationships, there are certain aspects of how the girls usually behave that differ from their brothers. The girls are emotionally attuned, quick to pick up on one family member feeling upset or not quite themselves and keen to talk about their feelings. Our sons are generally more matter-of-fact. They wouldn't necessarily pick up on someone's downbeat mood or voluntarily discuss their emotions. There are significant variations, of course, and considerable differences between the boys and between the girls. At each end of the spectrum or on specific occasions, a daughter might behave in a more masculine way than a son, but a gender pattern exists nonetheless. The boys and girls also tend to have different interests and enthusiasms. Again, not perfectly delineated, but still noticeable biases in their preferences. As small children, both girls and boys tended to play with gender stereotypical toys, even though the younger members of the family can choose whatever they liked from the rather big selection we had amassed by the time they came along. Richard and I never encouraged the girls to play with dolls or the boys with cars or trains. They just chose them. The girls have taken an interest in decorating their bedrooms and picking out their clothes, even as toddlers. The boys have rarely expressed a view on decor or clothes, except when they really don't like my suggestions. And their friendships differ too. The younger girls often ask for play dates, keen to initiate social contact, and when one has an argument with a friend at school, the upset tends to linger. A great deal of thought goes into who to invite to their birthday parties when we can't invite the whole class. They discuss who gets on with whom, not just their own best friends. As children, the boys were happy to go on a play date or a party if asked or arranged for them, but they could take it or leave it. They would know very clearly who they wanted at their own celebrations, although they haven't really been so interested in having these as their sisters. Team sports have been their main social activity. And if they got into an argument with someone at school, they picked up with them the next day as if nothing had happened. The boys and girls approach exams in distinct ways too, perhaps partly as a result of their schooling as well as innate differences. The boys tend to carry on much as usual, playing a great deal of sport right up until even the most important public exams. The girls focus entirely on their studies, ceasing all social activities for many months beforehand, carving the odd half hour out of their revision schedule to eat, but shunning all distractions. As I was writing this, 17-year-old Millie came home from school after a week of mock A-levels, complaining that her joints had gone stiff, because it's been so long since I did any exercise. Millie is sporty, plays netball well, enjoys tennis and loves activity holidays. Her older brother, by just a year, who had the same university offer, went on a 15-day school cricket tour in Sri Lanka ahead of his mocks, along with a number of his peers, and comfortably got his grades in place. The results seem much the same, the preparation very different. I confess to being just like my daughters, studying every hour of the day. My sister reminded me recently that included Christmas Day, which I'm not proud about. I was always pushing myself to achieve the next goal, but at the time didn't really consider where it might all lead to, or look to gain broader experience. I've come to recognise this as a typical conscientious girl's approach, concentrating on the finishing line that's immediately ahead, on getting the next certificate, badge or grade. The trouble is, developing a great career is not like passing an exam. There is no test date, no objective assessment, no certificate. There are relationships to navigate and risks to be taken, failures that will inevitably be incurred as well. We need to prepare young women for that. Learning to deal with failure is a particularly difficult and yet essential skill for girls. We need to understand that failure is inevitable, that it's not just okay to fail, but part of life. Winston Churchill was right to say that success is not final, failure is not fatal, it is the courage to continue that counts. In my experience, girls' fear of failing is often stronger than boys. I'm sorry to say that our older daughters exhibit much more self-doubt than their brothers. Their conversations are peppered with, "I'm not very good at that," or "I don't think I can do it." And when my husband and I try to help them choose exam subjects or courses, they start by excluding weak areas rather than listing strengths. It is exasperating, but also makes Richard and me feel sad that they do not appreciate their own talents. They can spot the problem in others. Age 16, our daughter Clara wrote her application to become a school prefect. She observed that the younger girls in the school were greatly hindered by self-doubt, and I would like to help others overcome this. So many girls miss out on opportunities because of this fear of failure. Insightful, accurate comments. Yeah, when I asked Clara, who is a wonderful prize-winning artist as well as academically strong, if she felt confident in her own ability to succeed, she replied, "Not really. I'm afraid that there will be lots of people who are better than me at whatever I decide to do." As a parent, it's hard not to respond, "Ah!" I have seen the problem reinforced rather than countered by girls' schooling. At one parent's evening, a form teacher was trying to encourage another daughter, Flo, to continue academic studies and apply for university. Flo was a talented musician who was quite adamant from a young age that she did not want to go to university. I explained that she had applied to a performing arts school, was enjoying writing music, and that this was where she saw her future. The teacher looked aghast. "But she might fail." "But she might succeed," I replied. "I have never heard any of our boys discouraged in this way, particularly when they have an obvious talent." Emphasizing the fear factor has an even bigger adverse impact on girls than it would do on boys. A retired teacher friend shared the experience of tutoring his first girls-only A-level retake group. 8 weeks into the program, he was alarmed by their lack of progress. He thought about his teaching method and realized that he might need to reconsider the more stick-than-carrot approach that worked so well with many groups of boys. He changed tack with the girls, praising them and building their confidence. The positive transformation in the girls' performance was startling. In the workplace, we have a much bigger body of admittedly mainly anecdotal evidence about behavioral distinctions between men and women. There is general informal agreement that men and women tend to behave differently in some respects. Again, this isn't being judgmental. It's not that men or women are better, just that there are, on average, perceptible differences. Women are typically conscientious, analytical, work well in teams, express their ambition quite subtly or ambiguously, and don't tend to promote themselves or think about their careers as strategically as men. Women also seem to worry more and are introspective, questioning what we have done, going over the issues again and again, and we often visibly show how hard we find it to take negative feedback. Many of us will recognize feminine or masculine traits almost intuitively. The debate between friends and colleagues is usually less about whether the differences exist and more about the cause. Are the differences biological or the result of social norms? Would men and women exhibit no behavioral differences at all if we were all exposed to the exact same expectations and situations? My own experiences, particularly as a mother, lead me to believe that both society and biology play a role in determining gender differences. We would still be somewhat different even if exposed to exactly the same circumstances. It is not a minor point. Acknowledging and appreciating our innate or biological differences is, I believe, critical to moving on from so many years of frustrating lack of progress towards gender equality in the workplace. I'm not a neuroscientist or any kind of scientist, but as I have sought to understand why our cumulative efforts have not yet delivered that equality or anything close, I have found that some of the research is very consistent with my practical experiences in both family and working life. Deborah W. So is a neuroscientist based at York University in Toronto. She is candid about the controversies that accompany her work, suggesting that people think you're sexist if you argue that there are biological sex differences in the brain. She points out that sex differences have nothing to do with gender equality. I understand where people are coming from in that they fear these differences will be used to justify female oppression. But instead of distorting science, we should be challenging why female typical traits are seen as inferior and undesirable in the first place. Professor Simon Baron Cohen is a neuroscientist at Cambridge University who has spent many years researching the differences between male and female brains. He delayed finishing his book, The Essential Difference, because he felt that the topic was just too politically sensitive to complete in the 1990s. He emphasizes that overall intelligence is not better in one or other sex, but relative strengths in different areas are different between the two sexes. His theory is the female brain is predominantly hardwired for empathy. The male brain is predominantly hardwired for understanding and building systems. To many of us, this will seem reasonable, based purely on our personal observations. Of course, we can all think of women who are not empathetic at all, men who are strongly empathetic, and women who are highly systematic. The idea, though, is that on average, women and men exhibit the predominant traits. Professor Baron Cohen's hypothesis is based on analysis involving experiments conducted over 20 years. My favorite is one that involved observing over 100 one-day-old babies whose gender was not disclosed to the researchers. Each baby was shown two objects, a human face and a mechanical mobile, coloured and sized similarly to the face. Boy babies showed a stronger interest in the mechanical object. Girls showed a stronger interest in the face, based on how long they looked at each. A sex difference in social interests apparent on the first day of life, clearly before any exposure to gender stereotyping. Professor Baron Cohen expands on the qualities of empathy and systematizing. He describes empathizing as naturally tuning into another person's thoughts and feelings, not just reacting to their emotions, but reading the emotional atmosphere or being emotionally intelligent. He shows the reader photographs of people's eyes and invites us to choose which word best describes what the person in the picture is thinking or feeling. On average, women perform better on this reading the mind and the eyes test. The analysis of biological sex differences might make us feel uncomfortable in a number of respects. We may feel it undermines those who identify as a different gender to their birth gender or are non-binary. In fact, these neuroscientists make it very clear that there is a spectrum of genders based on biological markers as well as psychological aspects of identity. We may still feel wary about exploring biology as a source of explanation of any behavioural differences between men and women, but it is much harder to achieve progress if certain ideas are off limits. The controversy around Google engineer James Damore's leaked internal memo, Google's ideological echo chamber, shows how we have, at the very least, tied ourselves in knots over the issue. Damore's memo was not anti-diversity, as it has been described. It was a challenge to the company's approach to diversity and inclusion. In 2014, there was a wave of media criticism about the lack of diversity in Silicon Valley. Since then, Google, along with several other tech giants, has been trying hard to increase the proportion of female technicians, 20%, and significant underrepresentation of Hispanics and blacks in both engineering and leadership roles, between 1 and 3%. In recent years, the company has been completely transparent about the problem, stating, "When it comes to diversity at Google, there's more work to be done." It publishes comprehensive diversity data on its website across different job categories and by both gender and ethnicity, covering new hires as well as the existing workforce. The company also has some of the best names diversity groups anywhere. Gaygalas for LGBTQ employees and Greygalas for their older staff. But after several years of effort and considerable expense estimated at $265 million, there's been little improvement in the numbers. In his memo, Damore argued that a dogmatic view of the underlying cause, that implicit and explicit biases hold women back in tech and leadership, was clouding the thinking. He suggested that biological sex differences might have something to do with it, that women and men might tend to have somewhat different skills and interests. Damore took care to point out that many of these differences are small and there's a significant overlap between men and women, so you can't say anything about an individual given these population-level distributions. Damore was fired for breaching Google's code of conduct, and portions of his memo are inflammatory and simplistic. Silicon Valley's perceived bro culture makes it particularly difficult to separate out the various factors influencing the low numbers of women in leadership as well as technology positions. But if we can't even discuss the possibility that men and women might on average be somewhat different for fear of causing offence, we have surely gone way off track. Sticking to one narrow view to explain disappointing progress on diversity contradicts what it means to be diverse and inclusive. The Heterodox Academy was established in 2017 to encourage diversity of thought at universities. Its members are all professors who have endorsed this statement. "I believe that university life requires that people with diverse viewpoints and perspectives encounter each other in an environment where they feel free to speak up and challenge each other. I am concerned that many academic fields and universities currently lack sufficient viewpoint diversity, particularly political diversity. I will support viewpoint diversity in my academic field, my university, my department, and my classroom." Following the Google controversy, the Heterodox Academy's research director, Sean Stevens, pulled together a wide range of academic analyses of gender differences, noting the presence on both sides of the debate of some of the top researchers. It is frustrating that so little of the excellent research has ever been widely discussed. The media frenzy surrounding the Damore memo reprised a similar heated discussion in 2005 after then-Harvard President Lawrence Summers suggested that women's underrepresentation in top universities' STEM faculties might have something to do with innate gender differences. It's worth noting that the current Harvard president, Drew Gilpin Faust, is the first woman to have ever held that office, following 27 men. The controversy over Summers' remarks prompted a group of top psychologists to try to settle the argument at the time. The group was impressive not just for its members' impeccable academic credentials. They also represented a wide range of views. At one end of the spectrum, Diane Halpern, former president of the American Psychological Association and author of Sex Differences in Cognitive Abilities. At the other, Janet Shibley Hyde, whose papers suggest small and shrinking gender differences. Sean Stevens summarized the group's 41-page monograph. The authors find over and over again that the sex differences we observe often have a biological basis, yet are not direct readouts of biological processes. They emerge in the course of development and interaction with social processes, norms, and stereotypes in ways that can vary across cultures and decades. This seems a highly plausible assessment. The unanswered questions are, why did this compelling review not gain greater traction over a decade ago? And why do so many people still find the subject so controversial? Diversity is obviously not about being identical. It's about being different. And inclusion is about welcoming those differences, not submerging them. Many diversity efforts are unsuccessful because they are based on pushing women and other underrepresented groups into the same framework as men. The idea that women need to be the same as men to be as good as men is surely the one we should discourage. Being good at empathizing or history or writing is just as valuable a skill as systematizing or physics or maths. And although there may be a higher prevalence of certain skills amongst either girls or boys, it should be obvious that even those neuroscientists and psychologists who support the theory of cognitive sex differences do not claim that any skill belongs to either gender. I personally have always been much better at maths than, say, art, and that has made me more suited to a job in finance than fashion. But that doesn't make me better or worse than a designer, just different. The goal is to reach the point where we don't have to fit a narrow mould in order to be valued. A situation where many skills and the synergies between them are appreciated. What resonates with me is the idea that to understand our own behaviour, we also have to understand both cultural factors and biology, including how our different hormones affect the ways men and women respond to either successful or stressful situations. After the financial crisis, it was suggested that Lehman sisters might not have suffered the same fate as Lehman brothers. One trader turned neuroscientist had already researched the idea. John Coates was a financial markets trader in the 1990s when he saw how easy it was to get caught up in the dot-com bubble. I would see people get on a winning streak on the trading floor and go lunatic. It happened to me as well. For weeks, even months, you feel like the hero of the floor. Every trader who has made money knows what this feels like. You think you're infallible. Coates observed that financial market analysts tend to assume that all behaviour is rational. From his experiences on the trading floor, he felt that this was a mistake. To form a more accurate picture of a financial risk-taking, he decided to research the way our bodies react to winning and losing. Coates studied a group of male traders. He found that on days when traders made an above-average profit, their testosterone levels went up. When their testosterone levels rose, the traders tended to increase their risk-taking. Coates dubbed this feedback loop the winner effect. The problem was that eventually the trader became prone to excessive risk-taking. He would win, take on more risk, win again, and increase the bet, and so on, until he risked too much. Cortisol is the body's stress hormone. It plays a central role in our physiological and behavioral responses to a challenge. Coates' experiments showed that while testosterone rose on days when traders were winning, cortisol levels rose more when there was greater uncertainty, higher risk around the returns, rather than simply when the trader was losing. He warned in 2007, just ahead of the financial crisis, that the acutely elevated levels of testosterone and cortisol he had observed might affect a trader's ability to engage in rational choice. Coates suggested that to make the trading floor less vulnerable to irrational behaviour, financial institutions needed to hire more women. Women produce, on average, about a tenth of the testosterone that men generate and are therefore less prone to the winner effect. While he was trading himself, Coates had noticed that the few women traders became less caught up in the dot-com euphoria that affected their male colleagues. The problem is that women aren't particularly attracted to the trading floor or to the financial sector in general.